wish I was a doctor who could heal your broken heart, analyze each bruise and hear your story from the start, and stitch up every tiny tear with a ribbon and a bow, prescribe you some new medicine.
Hey everybody, this is Diane.
Hey, and I'm Todd. And this is...
This Conversation Rocks, episode 9.
Outstanding.
Which we decided that we're calling H's for Healthcare. We're sticking with our theme for a bit.
Being brought to you from a dumpy little hotel in Dallas, Texas.
And my palatial loft in Willow, Alaska. Well, I don't know if I'd say palatial, but I've got a nice view of the willow trees, so it's all good.
There you go. There you go. All right, so why are we calling this one H's for Healthcare when we just did H's for something else? Haters.
Well, because somehow or another we got riled up about healthcare when we were talking, and we decided that we needed to do a podcast about healthcare.
That's right. And how can we
I can't even remember how
could we possibly get riled up about healthcare? I mean, it's not like it's not in the news or a political hot button or, you know, just whining
something that I do, you know, several hours a day every week.
Exactly. All right, so why don't you go ahead and start us off?
Okay, so Act One, we decided to look at what the Affordable Care Act is and what it does. So basically, the Affordable Care Act, which people kind of derisively started calling Obamacare, and now people are just generally calling Obamacare, does a whole bunch of things. And there are a bunch of things that it doesn't do that we're going to talk about in Act Two. So it did some good things. It ended the pre-existing condition exclusion for anybody under the age of 19. So basically, if you got something awful like a childhood cancer, you can't be refused health care by a health insurance company.
That would be a bad thing, wouldn't you?
Right, right. So, you know, let's say you get leukemia as a kid. You can still get healthcare insurance when you're an adult.
Horrible.
Another thing that was really great is that it allowed kids to stay on their parents' insurance until the age of 26. So, for example, college students who are still in lengthy programs, they actually get a chance to still have insurance while they're in college and not worry about stuff like that.
That sounds good.
So that was a really great thing. It also ended what they call arbitrary withdrawal of insurance, which basically means that your insurance company can't cancel your policy without a good explanation. They have to have a good reason to cancel your insurance policy. I'm not sure that I totally understand what good explanation means and how flexible that is, but basically there is some protection for the consumer in terms of cancellation of policy.
Okay, that sounds good. So far I'm seeing lots of reasons why we should hate this.
Right, exactly. So far, lots of reasons we should want to attempt to repeal how many times now? Not quite sure how many times the Congress has attempted to repeal it
as
now.
As you put it last week, can't count that fucking eye.
So another thing that the Affordable Care Act does is it guarantees your right as a consumer to appeal your plan's denial of payment. So say you had a procedure done in your healthcare provider's office that was deemed medically necessary, and then your insurance comes back and says, not going to pay for it. You have a right as the consumer to appeal that decision. The Affordable Care Act doesn't guarantee that payment's going to be made, but it at least gives you a right to argue with your insurance company.
Again, so far, not seeing any real reason why we should hate this. Because this, by the way, impacts everybody, right? All the things you've just
said,
that's for all of us.
Not just people on Medicare, not just people on Medicaid, not just people who got insurance after the Affordable Care Act became law, but people with any kind of coverage. Yep. So everybody's impacted by these changes. Another thing that it does that's really positive is it ends the lifetime limit on coverage. So, for example, if you had a really expensive healthcare condition, let's go back to cancer, because it doesn't take much if you have, say, $1 million lifetime limit on a health insurance policy to rapidly reach that and go beyond it if you've got an expensive condition like a cancer that needs chronic coverage or really expensive coverage up front. So, you know, before this, we would often find people who had maxed out their coverage and then basically had to pay for surgery, medications, additional treatments out of pocket.
Or not, right?
Or not get those treatments, exactly. Or declare bankruptcy because of healthcare costs. So that is theoretically not supposed to happen anymore. Another thing that the Affordable Health Care Act is supposed to do is it's supposed to make insurance companies publicly justify unreasonable rate hikes. And that's their language. That's the language in the bill, unreasonable rate hikes. Again, I'm not really sure exactly what that means. So I think there's quite a bit of wiggle room there.
Right. The courts will ultimately decide what is reasonable or unreasonable, since it's not,
right.
It's not explained.
Right. And I think that the insurance companies probably have some pretty highly paid attorneys who could argue that one.
Yes, absolutely.
Another thing is that it attempts to lower administrative overhead or administrative costs, and it mandates that the bulk of the dollars that you spend paying your insurance premiums must be spent on healthcare, directly on healthcare, rather than on administrative costs.
Well,
so, again, not a bad thing, right?
Yeah, I wonder what the mechanism for that actually is.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they actually account for that. And there's some information that I'll go into later that actually seems to suggest that that's not really being borne out. The other thing is that it mandates that preventive healthcare, so for example, your annual wellness visit and annual labs, be covered at no cost to the patient. But I've got to tell you, as a healthcare provider, I'm already running into some wiggle room on that. There are some plans that have somehow managed to circumvent that and don't offer wellness exams to patients. So then patients come in thinking they've got a wellness benefit. We bill their visit as a wellness benefit, and they end up getting stuck with the cost for that visit, which is pretty lousy, because they're not inexpensive visits.
I would not imagine they were.
Yeah, so not quite sure how these insurance companies are still able to wiggle around that part of the law. Offering preventive care was supposed to be a big part of the Affordable Care Act, so not quite sure how that's mapping out. Anyway, the other thing is, and this is definitely not happening either, it's supposed to protect your choice of your primary care provider, but the caveat is if it's in-network. So, you know, the whole promise about if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor?
Yeah, I remember that.
The caveat. Yeah, so the whole caveat with that was if you bought a plan that your doctor had bought into and was part of that network. So, which people don't always understand what that means.
Right now, but this, you know, but that specifically, though, is dealing with people who are getting insurance through this and not from their employer, right?
Right. Or, you know, it also counts if someone's employer, for example, switches their health insurance coverage. I mean, you could change plans and suddenly your provider could become out of network and you could lose the ability to see someone with whom you've been established for a long time.
Right. Right.
So it's always important, you know, just a little tip to people out there who are not great consumers of healthcare. It's always important to call your insurance companies and see if your provider's covered, if the medication, test, or procedure that they're talking about doing is covered, because there aren't any guarantees, which is some of the stuff that we'll talk about a little later, too. Let's see. The other thing is the Affordable Care Act guarantees that even if an emergency room that you are near is out of network for your plan, if it is a true emergency, you can seek care at that emergency room and it will still be covered. So.
Right. Which, again, that makes a lot of sense, right?
And I actually am not sure how that's changed a whole heck of a lot, because there is a law called EMTALA. Those are the initials that we always referred to it as when I worked in the emergency room. And it basically means if you walk into the emergency room with an emergency, we have to treat and stabilize you by law. We can't look at your insurance card and say, I'm sorry, you got to be at the ER across town.
Now, is that a federal law or is that a state thing?
It's a federal law. So I'm not quite sure how this changed that dramatically, but that is something that was written into the Affordable Care Act as well.
Well, what I believe it changes actually was that your plan had hospitals that were in network and ones that were not. And if you went to one that was not, you know, you were going to pay out of network prices.
That, you know, that's probably accurate. You're right. Basically, EMTALA means that we can't refuse care, but it doesn't mean that we can't bill you like crazy for the care that we give you.
And my God, it is crazy.
I know. I know. Tell me about it. I'm appalled sometimes at the prices that are quoted to me just for some of the things that we do in clinic. It's pretty amazing. So the other stuff that I looked at for the affordable care was basically how it's paid for, because people have talked a lot about the subsidies that some people qualify for in terms of paying for the insurance that they're supposed to get.
Again, this specifically, we're talking about people who didn't have insurance before, who can't get insurance through their employer, and now.
And who don't qualify for Medicare or Medicaid.
Right.
And I just want to be clear, because people always get confused about Medicare and Medicaid. So Medicare is the federal program, and it is for seniors, and it's for people who are disabled. And then Medicaid is the state-run program. It does get federal funds, but it's a chunk of money that's administered by each state, kind of how the state wants to spend that money.
Right, the so-called block grants.
Right. So Medicaid varies somewhat from state to state, whereas Medicare is standard across the United States, and it's for a specific group of people.
Right.
So the subsidies actually are designed to help people who are low income but not low enough income that they qualify for Medicaid, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah, the working poor. Everything,
yeah, basically.
Everything in this country is predicated on a certain dollar amount. And if you make $1 over, you don't have access to this program.
Exactly. And so the subsidies are created for people who make between 100% to 400% of the federal poverty level. And the way that those subsidies come to them is they're tax credits that come back to them to reduce the cost of the coverage of their plan.
Sounds reasonable.
And then the way that the Medicaid expansion that's been proposed works is that's for people who make under 138% of the poverty level. They would qualify for Medicaid expansion, which, you know, even as someone who works in healthcare, that just sounds like a lot of garble to me. I mean, I have to kind of really think that through in terms of what that means. It just basically means that you have to be really poor to qualify for the subsidies, and even more impoverished to qualify for Medicaid or the Medicaid expansion.
Right, and
I mean, I know
the
that
Medicaid expansion, it's worth noting, didn't happen in all the states, right?
Right. I actually looked up numbers today to see where we were at. And as of today, according to the Kaiser Health Foundation, 17 states and that includes the District of Columbia, adopted the Medicaid expansion. 17 states have refused it. Actually, those numbers don't work out, do they? I'll have to look that back up. 30 states have adopted, 17 states have refused it, and then 4 are actually quote-unquote under discussion.
And is it the ones that refused it, or is it the usual suspects?
It's the usual suspects. They're pretty much red states all around, and the 4 that are under discussion are pretty much red states all around. For example, Alaska, we're still considered under discussion. Our governor, Bill Walker, did say that he was going to make it a priority in his administration to expand Medicaid, but we have a pretty red legislature and they're fighting him tooth and nail on the expansion.
Yeah, well, we could go on for hours with what's wrong with the Alaskan legislature. And maybe we will.
We absolutely could. On another date. So I actually did a little bit of looking at what the arguments are for, or rather what the arguments are against Medicaid expansion. And I just found on some crazy conservative website a list of why we shouldn't expand Medicaid. So I'm just going to go through some of these. And, you know, some of them are not unreasonable arguments, and some of them I'm just going to throw the bullshit flag on them. So bear with me. Right. So one of the arguments is we shouldn't expand it because we need to halt the expansion of an already broken system. And I can't entirely disagree with that. Medicaid is not a great system. It's better than nothing, but I think we could do better.
Sure, but they're talking about doing nothing. And your argument would be that, well, we should consider a better system, which we're going to talk about here in a minute.
Right, we are.
So, yeah. All right. But that's the normal argument. Goes somewhere along the lines of the market should be allowed to do whatever the market does, fuck the poor, you know.
Right.
It's not our problem.
And it pretty much is a fuck the poor argument. I agree with you there. Another argument is that if we expand Medicaid, you're going to see increased wait times for procedures, for appointments, for those kinds of things. And, you know, I throw the bullshit flag on that one because people who have no coverage, their wait time is forever. Their wait time is they don't get procedures. They don't get appointments because they don't have the money to pay for those kinds of things.
Right, and they end up in the ER.
Right, and we end up paying three times the amount, or they end up with such a serious problem because it wasn't treated when it was a minor problem that it becomes life-altering.
Exactly.
Or life-ending.
Right, which isn't what we're after. It might be what some of the opponents are after, but...
One of the other arguments is that if we expand Medicaid, there's going to be exploding Medicaid spending. Now, I have to say that that is not entirely untrue. We saw here in Alaska, this number was actually really stunning. We had something like 33 recipients not under Medicaid expansion, but under just the Affordable Care Act insurance plans that were obtained over the last year. Something like just 33% of the people who signed up were responsible for a huge part of the budget.
But that's to be expected. Once you actually start offering this program, basically there's this huge backlog of need that has never been addressed. And yes, you're going to see explosive growth.
Bingo. So what you have is you have the incredibly sick, you have the incredibly underserved, at least in the first few years of a program like this, with tremendous costs because they're basically playing catch up on years of having nothing.
But again,
so they're getting everything fixed that hasn't been dealt with.
Again, hard to say though that that's a bad thing.
Right. I'm just saying that it's not an invalid argument that we're going to see significant increases in costs in the first few years of something like
this.
Right,
but the next step of that argument is, because of that, we shouldn't do it. And that's the problem, is that we have to do this for a lot of reasons, but mostly we should be able to, in the United States, we should be able to get all of our people through a doctor.
And my next step in the argument of this is, yeah, so we have exploding costs for a couple of years, but once we get people educated about how to use the healthcare system and in a healthier balance, we should see a leveling out.
Hopefully. And if we don't, well, then you know, we'll talk about it some more then.
Right. So another argument is that more doctors will drop out of accepting Medicare and Medicaid patients, which we're definitely seeing that. A lot of providers are choosing not to take Medicare and Medicaid patients because The reimbursement is poor. The wait time to be reimbursed for those patients from the payers is poor.
But it's worth noting that this has nothing to do with the act itself. And this has everything right. to do with the fact that Congress, by and large, has not done their job and passed the doctor payment plan each year. I think we just got one through Congress in the last couple of weeks. It's the first time in several years. So yeah,
well,
because Congress doesn't do this, the rate of acceptance by doctors continues to diminish because they got to make a living too.
And I'm also going to say something that's going to offend a lot of people. Some people are just greedy motherfuckers. You know, I mean, really, how much more money can you spend? How many more rooms can you add to your house? How many more cars can you drive? How many more vacations can you take? I mean, I make a pretty good living. I really do. And I'm not making the money that the specialists are making.
True, but the specialists are never going to take Medicare. Right?
That's not entirely true. Some of them do. Right, but if
you're cardiology or, you know, one of the high-paying specialties, right?
If you're cardiology, you have to see Medicare. That's your bread and butter, man.
Bad example, maybe. But, you know, there are lots of specialties where, you know, you're making your money off the private sector completely. Right? But, I mean, you know, when you're talking about general practitioners, you know,
We're seeing an interesting model that's kind of coming forth too. There are some GPs who are starting concierge services,
right.
So you know they'll have that flat fee. You know, you pay me whatever $500 a month, and I'll be your private doctor on call 24/7 for everything.
Right, and completely skipping the insurance portion.
Right.
All of it.
Right.
Not a bad play on the part of the physician.
No, not a bad play on their part. Not a great choice for us average human beings who, you know, put our pants on one leg at a time and walk on the dirt. But let's see, what else? What are some of the other arguments? Let's see, states will have higher costs when the Affordable Care payments decrease. That's true.
That again is the way this always works with grants and blocks. Block grants,
sure.
And any of the other so-called entitlement programs, anyway. So, okay.
And the thing is you figure it out.
Right.
You know, you figure out a way to build in a system that covers those costs as the payments change, as the payment structure changes. Sure. Let's see. Another thing that I'm going to throw the bullshit flag on because I just hate the language. It will worsen the cycle of dependence.
It's not even.
Well, you know what?
Worth addressing. That's just. Again, the right wing's claim that we're all a bunch of takers and none of us give in.
Right.
You know, what is it, the 47% who are just
right.
living off the largesse of Mitt Romney.
And I'm here to tell you, I believe that healthcare is a right. Healthcare is not a privilege. A boob job is a privilege. Getting basic healthcare is a right.
Seems to me that makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just a flaming liberal. By the way, I confessed to all of the people who look at our Facebook page, I am clairvoyant. I predicted Bernie Sanders. Okay, back to the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion. Let's see. Other arguments. Job creation claims are exaggerated. You know, I have mixed feelings about that. I actually think that Medicaid expansion could potentially create a lot of jobs.
Sure. But, you know, here's the thing. Nobody ever knows. When you start talking about, oh, it's, you know, such and such a program is going to create such and such a number of jobs and stuff, they're never right. You know, it's never going to collect as much revenue, or it's never going to cost as little as they say, or, you know, whatever, right? It's always wrong.
Well, you know, and the other thing is we still have such an extreme shortage of primary care providers, general health care providers, that those slots have to be filled. That's the word I'm looking for. And I'm going to kind of get on my own little personal bandwagon here, which is that if you live in a state where nurse practitioners do not have full autonomous practice, you need to be talking to your legislature, because we have the education, we have the knowledge, we have the background to have full autonomous practice, and we are capable of helping to close that primary care gap.
Absolutely.
And it's a real shame if we're not allowed to utilize the skills and the knowledge that we have. So just throwing that in there. Let's see what else. Crowds out private coverage. If we expand Medicaid, we crowd out private coverage.
That's how it works.
Totally throwing the bullshit flag on that one. If people could afford private coverage, they wouldn't need Medicaid expansion.
Right, and you'd be getting it through your employer like the rest of us and everything else.
Right.
And here's the other thing too, right? It's not like the insurance companies don't support some of this stuff, because like Medicare, the insurance companies are happy as hell not to have everybody over the age of 65.
Right.
You know, they're happy as hell not to pay the insurance insurance related stuff for that. So
I'm going to throw another one at you, because this one makes no sense to me. The claim is that expanding Medicaid raises premiums on private insurance.
Only if they want to.
Yeah, I don't get that.
No, because price would go up, according to market theory, right? Price would go up because the demand is higher for the product, right? And this is not market forces. This is taking a group of people who are not getting insured and providing them coverage. The argument may have something to do with the fact that the insurance companies, basically, when you go to the website and you get your insurance that you didn't used to have, you got to pay some back. It's still an insurance program.
Right.
Being covered by, the usual suspect, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, etc. So maybe that's what the argument is because we're forcing them to participate in this, which I don't think we are, but, costs will go up.
Yeah, I don't know. Of all of the arguments, that's the one that made the least sense to me.
My explanation didn't help at all.
Then another argument was undercompensated care is worse than covering uncompensated care. So basically, because the payment on Medicaid is so poor to rendering providers, that it actually is worse than having to cover uncompensated care to rendering providers altogether, which I also think is complete bullshit.
I'm sorry, because I don't even understand what you just said.
So what they're basically saying is, for example, our little hospital here where I live, we serve a lot of uninsured people, and they end up writing a lot of that off as bad debt.
Sure.
And so the argument is that having to take lower payments from a whole bunch of people who are insured by Medicaid expansion, as opposed to writing off a bunch of bad debt by people who aren't insured at all, is worse.
Okay, let me be clear. I speak English and I understand each of the words you just said, but I still have no.
But you don't know how they go together.
I
know, because they don't go together in any logical way, do they? Okay, and then let's see. They say that that expansion increases the risk of Medicaid fraud and waste. To which I say, look at all the douchebags who are arguing for drug testing people who are getting welfare. There have been very, very few documented cases of catching people who are actually using drugs and getting welfare. But it's wasted a hell of a lot of money in the states that have implemented it. Enough said, right? Let's see. Oh, and this was my favorite. The states that say no to Medicaid expansion are setting a strong example to the states that haven't made their decision yet.
Yeah, so here's the thing that really cracks me up, right? The numbers seem to indicate that the blue states put in, for every buck the blue states put into the feds, in the form of taxes, we get, something like 89 cents back to the state level. The grant system and stuff. for every dollar the red states put in, it seems like they get something like a buck, I think it was a buck 12 or something like that, right? Which,
dude, Alaska's living proof.
Yeah, you know.
We are.
Exactly. So, yeah, you're sending a strong argument by convincing the remaining four states not to do this, because the message is basically, well, we'll just, I don't know what, but we'll just continue to get the money, federal grants, all that crap. Yep. You still got to take care of your people. Boy, that was a really crappy way of saying all that.
But I think that you actually hit one of the main arguments on the head. We're really selfish. We don't care anymore. We don't care about taking care of each other.
I'm not sure we ever did, but yes. If we ever did, we certainly don't know.
It's really true. We really, you know, and I actually, so I had kind of a difficult case on Friday, and I can't really go into the details of the case because I don't want to violate this patient's privacy, obviously. But it was complicated, and there were a lot of difficult social factors that kind of overlaid that made it even worse. And one of the people that I work with said, he obviously doesn't care about himself. You shouldn't care about him either. And that came from an educated healthcare professional. And I was so disappointed, because even though I was really frustrated with the patient, and this patient pretty much always presents chaos whenever he presents, I still care about the outcome, and I still want to try to help this person get a handle on his life.
Right.
You know? And so to have an educated professional telling me that I shouldn't care was really disappointing.
Yeah, it's kind of bad.
But it's kind of emblematic of our nation as a whole, and the division, and just the attitude that we shouldn't care about each other, that we should care about our own little pocket of the universe, but nobody else.
So, 33 minutes into a...
I know. I'm sorry. So the end of Act One is that, also they argue that if we accept Medicaid expansion, it takes away the whole idea of states' rights, that we accept the federal government dictating to us how we manage our Medicaid dollars.
Yeah, this is the state right thing. It's just an ongoing bunch of...
I know. It's another argument. It's another red herring. It's another piece of code for...
We don't like what the feds are doing.
Right.
So we're gonna claim states' rights and everything. Yeah. Yes, you do have rights as a state. However, they don't supersede the rights of the federal government. I don't know. It's just crazy. Crazy talk. So here's what I'm going to propose, right? Is that this whole piece, Act 1, right? We'll record Act 2 separately. Right?
Okay.
And that'll be next week.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for people who haven't seen the website and the updates, Todd, who is traveling for a living, who has a small business, actually is having to do some traveling this week, and so we're not recording as long as we usually do. So I have to respect his time. I could talk all night because I love to hear myself talk, especially into my sexy new microphone. But
we love to hear you.
I respect that. So we'll save Act Two. Act Two is actually kind of what the Affordable Care Act didn't do.
Yeah.
And what some of us were really hoping it would do.
Right. And
then go ahead.
Also known as the more things change, the more they kind of stay the same.
Right. And then Act Three, I just really wanted to talk about some of the personal things that I've seen, especially in my years of working as a primary care provider, and how we could really make some meaningful change with some changes in our system.
Sounds like a good plan, and that's what we're going to do.
I could be the doctor, you could be the patient, instead of operation, given to any temptation.
So, do you have an oh, by the way moment for tonight?
Yeah, yeah. Ken Ham, creationist extraordinaire.
So we talked about him in Diaz for Dinosaur.
Just got his hands on some dinosaur bones that were apparently donated to him, to the Creationist Museum. And he and his expert are going to investigate these bones and be able to visually confirm that these bones are not 65 million years old, but are in fact a couple thousand years old.
They're going to visually confirm that.
Visually confirm that. Because there's only observable history.
So he carbon dates with his eyes now?
No, carbon dating is a myth.
Oh.
You know.
So I'm just curious, did he say how he was going to visually confirm this? I'm just still not quite...
An explanation that makes any sense to anybody was not forthcoming.
So are you going to give us an update on this when there's more?
Should there ever be an update on it, I would be more than willing to share it. But here, in fact, let me go ahead and spoil it for you. Ken Ham has visually determined that those bones are only a couple thousand years old. I, too, am clairvoyant.
You're probably right. I bet you are. And now we've spoiled it for all of our listeners. We know.
Sorry.
We know the future.
All right. You got to know, by the way?
I do. And you know what's really cool? So it ties in the upcoming presidential election, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and conspiracy theories. God. How good is that?
All right. I'm sitting down.
Okay.
Hit me.
So this comes from the Rachel Maddow Show. When responsible, mature public officials are asked about the Jade Helm 15 conspiracy theory,
holy shit, there are few... That stuff's crazy.
Now you gotta let me share with the listeners.
I'm sorry.
There are a few acceptable responses. What's the Jade Helm 15's conspiracy theory is a fine answer. And I'm just editorializing here. That was my answer. Never heard of it before. So is, I have real work to do and there's little time for fringe nonsense. But Dave Weigel talked to Senator Ted Cruz, Republican Texas, over the weekend, who offered a more troubling response to the same question. Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz said Saturday he's been hearing concerns about Jade Helm 15, a domestic military training exercise that has become a fount of conspiracy theories, and that he wanted questions about it to be answered. My office has reached out to the Pentagon to inquire about this exercise, Cruz, a Texas senator, told Bloomberg at the South Carolina Republican Party's annual convention. We're assured it's a military training exercise. I have no reason to doubt these assurances. But I understand the reason for concern and uncertainty, because when the federal government has not demonstrated itself to be trustworthy in this administration, the natural consequences is that many citizens don't trust what it's saying. As the Bloomberg Politics report added, the right-wing Texan went on to say that he's fielded a lot of questions over the conspiracy theory, adding, I think the part of the reason that we've seen for 6 years, a federal government disrespecting the liberty of citizens. That produces fear when you see a government that's attacking our free speech rights or Second Amendment rights or religious liberty rights. That produces distrust. Apparently, we're supposed to believe that the right-wing media figures have disseminated nonsense to right-wing activists who end up believing ridiculous theories, and this is all President Obama's fault. It's one of the reasons Cruz's posture is so hard to take seriously. As we talked about last week, the U.S. military is launching a training exercise called Jade Helm 15 over the summer, which will include a series of training drills throughout the Southwest, from Texas to California, for about 1,200 special operations personnel. In some right-wing circles, however, Jade Helm 15 is the basis for an extraordinary conspiracy theory. The idea gets a little convoluted, fringe theories often are. But the unhinged activists apparently believe that the Obama administration, in conjunction with the U.S. military and Walmart, is planning... I know, right? Is planning to impose martial law on much of the country.
Sorry.
As they see, that's okay. As they see it, the plan also includes gun confiscation and secret underground tunnels. So, Todd, last week we said Obama had not yet come for the guns.
This week he's coming.
This week he's coming for the guns, or at least this summer he's coming for the guns.
But only in the Southwest.
Right. So fear of the training exercise became so widespread that Texas Governor Greg Abbott ordered the Texas Guard to monitor the military exercises.
I know.
Just in case, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky also assured supporters he's on the case and will look into the matter, too. Part of the issue here is the oddity of Ted Cruz's office purportedly reaching out to the Pentagon directly. I'm trying to imagine how this conversation might go. Cruz's office. Some of our constituents are concerned that the Pentagon is launching an invasion that will lead to martial law. So, is the Pentagon launching an invasion that will lead to martial law? Pentagon. Nope. Cruz's office. Sounds good to me. If you're nutty enough to take the conspiracy theory seriously, wouldn't you also be nutty enough to assume the military is on to the elaborate scheme? Republican Todd Smith, a former Texas lawmaker, wrote to his governor last week, arguing that it's wrong for officials to pander to idiots. Smith added, is there anyone who's going to stand up for this radical nonsense that is a cancer on our state and on our party? I don't know the answer to that question, though it seems clear that Ted Cruz will not be that person.
Yep. Yeah. No, I started hearing about that. We really do have to do a conspiracy second edition.
A follow-up? I had never heard of Jade Helm 15, so when I saw that this morning, I thought, oh my god, that's perfect for an oh, by the way.
Yeah, that's been going out. I've seen it now for a couple weeks, so, but that's the most in-depth reporting I've heard on it so far. But yeah, I mean, it's just a military exercise in Texas, which is theoretically home to the military. I mean, they got some huge military bases here.
But actually, it's Walmart and the Pentagon conspiring to take your guns away.
Walmart, as in Sam Walton's Walmart?
As in Sam Walton.
The best thing about conspiracy is that being illiterate really helps. Cue the Mission Impossible theme song.
No, so on that note, I actually have the perfect Neil Gaiman quote, and it's from, let's see, it's from American Gods.
An excellent book.
Information and knowledge, two currencies that have never gone out of style.
Except here. In Texas, where I am for the next 2 weeks.
That's perfect. I forgot you were in Texas. So hang on to your guns. Grip them a little tighter, man.
Yeah, okay.
And on that note, we'll hit Act 1 and Act 2 from a seedy little hotel room in Dallas next week.
Exactly. All right, and we're out.